One of my favorite quotes about the providential care of God, the sovereignty of God, that he works all these things out for good, even the smallest details, comes from J.C. Ryle. He wrote some short little commentaries on the Gospels, and he said this: nothing whatever, whether great or small, can happen to a believer without God's ordering and permission. There is no such thing as chance, luck, or accident in the Christian's journey through this world. All is arranged and appointed by God, and all things are working together for the believer's good. Now, that's an easy enough quote to read. It's something else altogether to actually live that way. To actually live in a way where you're trusting and waiting patiently on God's grace. And so as we come to this section of the book of Ruth, chapter 2, we're going to highlight this issue of how it is that we wait patiently for God's grace. Over the course of your life, if you look back at your journey of faith, let's just consider for a moment. A little over 20 years ago, let's say 24 years ago, right at the time frame of the year 2000, that was a completely different world. iPhones didn't come out to 2007. We forget. That's how recent that is. And yet in 2000, your Christian life, your journey of faith, would have looked completely different in some ways than it does now. And in the course of that journey, I'm sure you could look back and tell of the twists and turns that you've gone through in the journey of faith. The moments where you've rejoiced with those who rejoiced and wept with those who weep. And in those different stages of your life of faith, I hope and pray that you can look back and see God's hand at work in those moments. It is a healthy reminder for us to see the way that God has worked in our life. And that's what we're doing with Naomi. In some ways, this book could have been titled Naomi instead of Ruth. The story unfolds in such a way that Naomi is a predominant character. Even when we get to chapter 4, you'll see that even when the child is born, they're speaking to Naomi and not Ruth. And so in Naomi's journey, as she is going through these difficult times, we're going to see how she holds on to her faith in the struggle. I'm sure as life started out in chapter 1, before they left their homeland, they had wonderful experiences, Naomi and her husband, of marriage and children. But we saw in chapter 1 that Naomi experienced many shattered dreams, moving into a foreign land, losing her husband, losing her two sons. One daughter-in-law leaves, and only one remains as she comes back to her home. But Naomi does not give up her faith, in spite of the fact that at the end of chapter 1, she tells them, "Do not call me Naomi," when she shows back up, which means pleasant. "Call me Mara," which means bitter. One of the things I love about Naomi is this brutal honesty. How many times would you show up to church after being gone for a while, and they say, "Oh, look who's here," and you say, "Don't call me that name. I'm not a happy person. Call me bitter." And then what's everybody going to think? Uh-oh, let's go the other way. We're not going to interact with that right now. So Naomi comes back feeling that she has lost everything. In fact, she says, "I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty." Although we could be tempted to judge Naomi for her blindness in this situation, because Ruth is standing right there beside her, one of the things we should realize from this story is that when life really does take those turns and we experience suffering or loss and pain, the temptation of bitterness is creeping up, and when that happens, we don't see the hand of God. We don't often see what somebody else is doing for us right in front of our face. And so as we turn to chapter 2, we want to see how Naomi holds on to God's grace until that turns. Or how Ruth actually is the one that holds on to hope until things shift. So as we move through chapter 2, we're going to see 3 points. First of all, and these 3 points concern areas of growth, ways that we can cultivate our faith. First of all, trusting in God's providence. No matter what the circumstance, God calls us to trust that He's at work behind the scenes. Secondly, we're going to highlight the need for seeing God's grace. We're going to see that in the interaction of Ruth and Boaz. And then thirdly, we're going to highlight the need to live in light of God's love. So trusting in God's providence, seeing God's grace, and living in light of God's love. So first of all, trusting God's providence. The very beginning of chapter 2. Remember, the word providence comes from 2 Latin words that means to see beforehand, to see ahead of time, but also that God is the God who cares for us. And so God is still at work in the life of Naomi, even though Naomi is not the one that has the confidence, the courage, the motivation to actually go do something. Look at chapter 2, verse 1. Now Naomi had a relative of her husband's, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. Now the writer of the book of Ruth gives us that hint in the first verse. But did Naomi remember that person back in the previous chapter when they were coming back into the land? No. She's like, I can't do anything for you, Ruth. I can't do anything for you, Orpah. Go back home and let me just go back on my own. What we have here is a possible solution to the fact that Ruth has no husband, because Boaz is a relative who could actually marry her and continue the family line. But now notice verse 2. Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, let me go into the field and glean among the ears of grain after him in whose sight I shall find favor. I find it fascinating, and we'll look at this more when we get to chapter 3, because Naomi kicks into fifth gear in chapter 3, but that it's Ruth who takes the initiative here. Ruth is the one that goes to Naomi. Not Naomi telling Ruth what to do. It's Ruth who goes to Naomi and said, let me go glean among the field. Now, contemplate that for a moment. Naomi knew the land. She knew the people. She knew this situation. She could have said to Ruth, here, I have an idea. Go do this. But because the bitterness is so painful and so strong, Naomi doesn't take that initiative. Ruth does, because Ruth is the one that has hope. So as we look at the need to trust God's providence, we need to be aware of a couple of things. First of all, God works through people. Sometimes when we're praying to God to do something, there's a person near us who's there doing the very thing we are asking God to do. But because it didn't come out of heaven like a lightning bolt, we don't think God's doing anything. God works through people. In this case, He works through Boaz, who is a very worthy man, described in verse 1 as a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech. He has a very good character. He has wealth, evidently, because he has land and farming. And you'll see even how he treats his workers. He comes out with the traditional Hebrew blessing, the Lord be with you, and they respond, the Lord bless you, or the Lord be with you too. The idea behind the name of Boaz is that he has an abundance of gifts. Another way to say that is that Boaz is overflowing with grace. But God also is at work through Ruth. God is using Ruth and Boaz to get to Naomi, to help Naomi come out of this bitterness and see God's grace. You can see Ruth's action here. With what we would call divine sovereignty, that God's in control of all things, comes our responsibility. Ruth can't sit at home and not do anything. Even though she could say, I've learned from you that your God controls all things, Naomi. If she sits at home and doesn't do anything, they're not going to make it. And so Ruth takes the initiative and goes out. Ruth is shown in verse 7 as a humble worker who says, please let me glean and gather among your reapers. And she's a hard worker. She works all day long. Not only does God work through people, but secondly, God works through events. And as we trust in his providential care, it's important that we see his guiding hand not only in the people that he sends our way, but the events that take place. No one is sitting here by accident this morning. And this is especially true this morning. I got up and went outside before we left for the hour and a half drive it takes to get here, and I thought, I'm going to have to crank my truck 45 minutes before we leave. It's so cold out here. So even while we were driving here, I was juggling the thermostat because anytime I went below like 76 on my thermostat marker, my feet got cold. And I thought, am I getting old or is it just really this cold out here and I can't stay warm, or I get it too high and I get hot? And I think, okay, if I were tempted, this would be one of those mornings when I could say, I think I'll just stay home. It's pretty warm right here by the fire. And yet, we're all here, gathered to worship the Lord, listening to this story from Ruth chapter 2. In spite of whatever it took to get here, God has something for you. It's not an accident that you're sitting here. God is at work in your life to guide and direct your life, just like he's doing Naomi, Ruth, and Boaz. So I love the way verse 3 puts it. She set out and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. Now, I'm reading from the ESV that says she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz. If I recall correctly, the old King James Bible said her hap happened. It takes an unusual Hebrew phrase and puts it like, oh, look, she just happened to land on this field. Well, if we're following this story, we know that this is not chance. It's not an accident that she landed on this field. Of all the fields she could have landed on, she landed on Boaz's field. And you can go, that's just a coincidence. Or you can see that and go, that's the guiding hand of God. Proverbs 16:9 says, a man's mind plans his way, but the Lord directs his steps. And so even though Ruth has taken that initiative, the Lord has directed her to Boaz's field. So not only do we need to trust in God's providential care and see his work through people and events, but secondly, we need to be able to see God's grace. I do think there's a fundamental aspect to the Christian life that calls us to work on what we see. It's fascinating to me in the Gospels how many times Jesus says, you have eyes, but you don't see. You have ears, but you don't hear. And he's not just talking to people who don't have faith. He's talking to the disciples a lot of the time because they're not seeing the world the way Jesus is explaining them to, trying to help them see the world. And I think this is an important point for growth in the Christian faith. By seeing God's grace, I'm not talking about evangelism or converting somebody. I'm primarily talking about believers keeping their eyes open to God's grace and being able to tell your story in light of God's grace. So, for example, Paul says this in 2 Corinthians 1, verses 3 through 4. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of and God of all comfort, who comforts us in our affliction, so that we may be able to comfort those who are in any affliction with the comfort with which we ourselves are comforted by God. To do what Paul says here means you have to see the way God's at work in your life and how God comforts you so that then you can become a conduit of God's grace. Paul goes on in 2 Corinthians, I think, to explain that you have two options as a Christian. You either become a channel of God's grace so that God's grace flows through you to other people, or in your bitterness, frustration, and anger, you close that channel off and shut that door. And then that grace doesn't flow through you. I've known a number of people that I've tried to help in pastoral context who have had such a difficult time, they cannot open themselves to other people. It's very hard for them to minister to other people and share the story of what they've gone through because it's so painful. But I'm fairly convinced that one of the ways God heals us is by that grace flowing through us to other people and sharing with them our afflictions so that we might comfort them. So in order to see God's grace, the first thing we see here is that we have to become a channel of God's grace. That's what Boaz is doing. That's what Ruth is doing. Boaz is so clearly a channel of God's grace here in this little section. Notice what he says to Ruth. He comes to her in verse 8. This is the next break of the section. The second point about seeing God's grace is verses 8 through 16. So Boaz says to Ruth, "Listen, don't go glean in another field or leave this one. Keep close to my young women. Let your eyes be on that field they are reaping and go after them. I've charged my men not to touch you. When you're thirsty, go drink from what they've drawn." Now Ruth realizes what's happened here. Look at what she does in verse 10. She falls on her face, bowing to the ground. A complete posture of humiliation. And she says, "Why have I found favor in your eyes that you would take notice of me, a foreigner? You don't know me. I'm not even of your people. So why are you showing me this kindness?" Now notice what Boaz says in verse 11. "All that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me. How you left your father and mother and native land and came to a people you did not know before. The Lord repay you what you have done, and a full reward be given to you by the Lord." Boaz sees in Ruth someone who has opened herself to the Lord, the true God, and has loved Naomi in the midst of her struggle and come back with her. Notice the language he goes on to use. "The Lord repay you for what you've done," this verse 12, "and a full reward be given to you by the Lord, the God of Israel," and this last expression, "under whose wings you have come to take refuge." That is a beautiful picture. So not only do we have the need to be channels of God's grace, but the second thing that we need to do as we see that grace is we need to take refuge under God's wings, as Ruth has done. I think the image there is beautiful. If we had time, that could be a whole message in and of itself. The Psalms are overflowing with this language. Psalm 94:1, "Under his wings I seek his refuge." Psalm 67:3, "For you have been my help, and in the shadow of your wings I sing for joy." Psalm 57:1, "Be merciful to me, O God, be merciful to me," crying out for mercy, "for in thee my soul takes refuge. In the shadow of your wings I take refuge." I've always found this fascinating because of the way that image of a bird and its wings and gathering its young. I find it the image more fascinating now that we have chickens. We have about 15 silky chickens, mainly because I just find them fascinating, the way they interact with each other. But sometimes one of those hens will get very broody and sit on the eggs. And I actually had this happen in the summer. She got so broody, she wouldn't let me get the eggs. There are about 6 of them. And every time one moved outside, and I had never seen this, like, in person myself. My grandmother had told me stories about it when she was younger and they were raising chickens. I've seen videos, but this little hen, well, I'd try to put in there and reach an egg, and she'd poke at me with her beak, and she'd take the egg and snap it back under her real quick and pull her wing under. And my mind thought to this image of how we are supposed to take our refuge under God's wings. In the same way, after those eggs are hatched, I've seen it happen in an incubator. You know, when they hatch, the chicken comes out of the egg. It has to stay in the incubator for a while because it's wet and it's little fur. It's not quite got feathers at that point. It's got to dry. If you have a mother hen right there with that little chick under it, you don't need an incubator. It's so warm, she keeps that little chick under her for the next several weeks until it gets enough feathers that it can sustain itself. That is the relationship God has with you. He takes you under his wings, keeps you warm, provides comfort, does all the things a mother hen, a mother bird would do. Such a beautiful picture of the gospel when you take your refuge under the wings of God. Now, I think that's also important because it's very clear, based on what we read in chapter 1 and what we're seeing in chapter 2, that Ruth has come to faith in the one true God and wants to be identified with God's people. And she learned, evidently from Naomi and her husband to some degree, that this God is a king who allows you to take refuge under his wing. And so, as we trust in God's providence, he guides us in ways that we cannot see. And as he does, not only do we have to trust his providence, but we have to trust his grace and see the ways that he's done it. Point number 3. This is verses 17 through 23. So, as we wait on God and we trust his providence and we see his grace in different places, it's critical that we live in light of his love. I think in one way this is the payoff, if you will, as we're coming upon the turning event for Naomi. Because once this happens, once what we see right here in this chapter takes place in Naomi's life, Naomi's not the same. Naomi turns a corner right here. Look at verse 17. Ruth gleans in the field. She comes back with about an ephah of barley. She took it up and went into the city. Her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. Ruth also brought out and gave her the food she had left over. And the mother-in-law said to her, "Where did you glean today, and where have you worked? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." Now, the way Naomi said that should be shock. Like, the language is, where in the world did you go? How did you end up with this much food? Because Naomi, I think, in coming back to the land, thought no one was going to help her. They were going to cast her aside because she left. She had no idea what was going to unfold. And so Ruth says, and Naomi's like, "Blessed be the man who took notice of you." Ruth tells her, and then she says, the end of verse 19, "The man's name with whom I work today is Boaz." Now, I would imagine that with the naming of Boaz, Naomi's whole countenance shifted from downcast when Ruth gets home. Probably there's no telling. You know, I imagine Naomi sitting in the corner just kind of curled up to herself, frustrated and bitter about the way life has gone. Ruth comes in with food and Naomi's surprised. And it's like, what is this? And then she names Boaz, and you can almost see in verse 20, well, you can see because our English translation should have an exclamation point at the end. "May he be blessed by the Lord whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead." Naomi remembers. Naomi had forgotten, but she remembers that this man can solve the problem that they have, that Ruth has no husband. They call it in Israel a kinsman redeemer. And you see in verse end of verse 20, "This man is a close relative of ours. He is one of our redeemers, or a kinsman redeemer. He's one of the people that we could appeal to for you to marry and continue the line. Ruth said, well, he also said to me to stay near. And so now, look at verse 22. It's amazing the power of God's love when you see it. Because Naomi now says in verse 22, it is good, my daughter, that you go out with these young women, lest in another field you be assaulted. So now she's telling Ruth, it's good for you to do this. This is a great plan. Stay close to him. The transformation that happened has to do with what we read in verse 20. May he be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead. That word in the ESV, it says kindness. You may have a translation, it may say steadfast love or something like that. It is the Hebrew word hesed. It's used three times in the book of Ruth. In Ruth 1:8, in Ruth 2:20, and in Ruth 3:10. That word hesed is the covenantal reminder that God is not only working things out, but he deeply loves them. It is the covenantal love that's described in the Old Testament. That's what grabbed Naomi's heart. That's what shifted things. She's saying, God's kindness, Boaz's kindness, their hesed has not forsaken us. Paul Miller has a wonderful book on the book of Ruth. It's titled A Loving Life, if you've ever seen it. It's a beautiful book about the story of Ruth and Naomi. And in that book, Miller describes it this way. And this is an excellent way to put it, because when you believe this, this is actually what changes us. He says, hesed is one-way love. Love without an exit strategy. When you love with hesed love, you bind yourself to the object of your love no matter what the response is. So if the object of your love snaps at you, you still love that person. If you've had an argument with your spouse in which you were slighted or not heard, you refuse to retaliate through silence or withholding your affection. Your response to the other person is entirely independent of how that person treated you. Hesed is stubborn love. Now, the reason why I find that so helpful is that kind of love is critical for a person of faith in the culture in which we live, where love is a feeling, and if I don't feel like I care for you now, then I'm going to make another choice. Oh, you're sick now? I didn't sign up for that. I'm going to do something else. You're older now? I want someone younger. You fill in the blank of whatever our culture does when it's a feeling that constantly changes, so now I don't care, and you change your commitment. But hesed love, what is it? It's love without an exit strategy. That's who God is. He loves you without a plan to stop loving you. In fact, the book of Jeremiah says he loves you with an everlasting love, which means it never had a beginning and will never have an end. That's the kind of love Naomi realized right here. It is love without an exit strategy. And that's the depth of love God reveals in this book to Naomi. And that kind of love transforms your life. Because then you start believing that God truly does care. And God's love is not dependent on how well your job's going, on how well your marriage is functioning, at how good the church is doing. God's love does not depend upon any of these external circumstances, because hesed love can sustain you through anything that falls apart. Because you have a hope beyond this present world that you see. That is the essence of what the gospel is telling us. And so as we wrap up chapter 2, we see that not only is it true that in the course of our life, events happen, and they're very painful, and they shatter our dreams, and it's not what we expected, and it's not what we wanted. But in the midst of that struggle, God in His love is guiding our steps and loving us and walking with us in whatever we face. And that's why we call this message good news. Because it's overwhelming good news that you will never be left alone and never forsaken. Let's pray.